This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with Peter Weiss from the Center for Constitutional Rights about the recent settlement in the Royal Dutch Shell case.
$15.5 million to representatives of the Ogoni people. The case had its origins 13 years ago, but the law on which it was based goes back to early pioneering work by Center for Constitutional Rights Vice President Peter Weiss.
We'll also hear excerpts from speeches from the event titled Torture and the Need for Justice. Stay with us.
Last week, we had some good news and some bad news. Some good news on some of the issues, torture, detention, and the like, and some bad news on those same issues. The good news, and it's very good news, is that a civil suit for damages, really only $1 in damages, but also seeking a declaration that his treatment was unconstitutional, was won at the first level by Jose Padilla. Jose Padilla, you recall, was the American citizen pulled off a gangplank when he entered into Chicago, held in a military brig for a number of years, interrogated, treated inhumanely, tortured, deprived of access to his family, lawyers, or anything else. And really, one link in the chain of that conduct against Jose Padilla was advice given by John Yoo, who was the lawyer at the Office of Legal Counsel under Bush. Jose Padilla went ahead and, with a team from Yale Law School, sued John Yoo for the $1 in damages and declaration that his conduct was unconstitutional. John Yoo asked the court to dismiss the case, claiming under various legal doctrines that there was no right to sue him, that he had various kinds of immunity. The Obama administration actually helped defend John Yoo in this case, which is pretty interesting in and of itself. But happily, the court didn't buy into Yoo's or the Obama administration's argument and refused to dismiss the case against John Yoo, which means the case will go to trial. John Yoo's principal argument was that at the time the conduct was committed, no court had held it was unconstitutional to label someone an enemy combatant and treat him as an enemy combatant was then treated under the Bush doctrine. What the court said was interesting. The court said it may be that the status of enemy combatant had never been decided by a court one way or another. But no matter what a person's status is, they cannot and could not be treated the way Jose Padilla was treated. I just want to read you a couple of sentences from the judge's opinion in Padilla versus Yoo. It's an exciting, strong opinion. First, the court said, the basic facts alleged in the complaint clearly violate the rights afforded to citizens held in the prison context. The complaint alleges that the military agents entered a civilian jail, seized a citizen from the civilian justice system, transported him to a military brig, detained him there indefinitely without criminal charge or conviction, deprived him of contact with anyone, including attorneys or family, removed the basic ability to practice his religion, and subjected him to a program of extreme interrogations, sensory deprivations, and punishment over a period of 3 years and 8 months. The specific designation as an enemy combatant does not automatically eviscerate all of the constitutional protections afforded to a citizen of the United States. And you know, it's one that I always wondered about. We always knew the answer that the judge gave, but it always seemed extraordinary to me. Just because you put one label on a person instead of another label, does that mean that the person is no longer a human being? Well, the judge in this case said, you remain a human being and you still have basic and fundamental constitutional rights. So possibly we're going to begin to find at least a modicum of justice against John Yoo. An additional piece of good news is that finally, after 4 months in office, or over 4 months, the Obama administration has started to release some of the people from Guantanamo. Four of the 17 Uyghurs remaining at Guantanamo, who have been there for 7 years, who are completely innocent of everything, were finally sent to Bermuda. We've seen some great pictures of them on the beach, of them going swimming, of them going shopping. It's caused a bit of a dispute in Bermuda There's some issues about whether the current government of Bermuda will fall as a result, but it is great that Bermuda is willing to take four of the men. And when you see them and you read their histories, you understand that the fact that they spent one day in jail, much less almost 7.5 years, is just an outrage. They shouldn't have been there at all. And we would hope that President Obama continues to try and empty Guantanamo in a very, very serious way. That's the good news. The good news, interestingly enough, and I think people should notice this, is coming from a court and not from what I call the political branches in this country, the Congress or the president's office. In fact, it's been an historically interesting point that in the 8 years of the Bush administration and really going forward into the Obama administration, we've been winning our cases on fundamental rights from the courts and not from Congress, where we always get worse legislation rather than better, and not from the president, whether it was Bush or Obama. And I'm talking about particularly these issues of Guantanamo, detention, torture, etc. And that pattern is repeating itself, not just with the Padilla versus Yu case, but also in this whole idea of state secrets. You remember what that is. State secrets in the old days was when the government came in and said a particular piece of evidence can't be used in court, and you would argue about it, and perhaps it was used, perhaps it wasn't used. Under the Bush administration, a much broader assertion of state privilege took place, in which they said the entire subject matter of the case, a case, for example, concerning rendition, which is the one I'm going to mention, has to be dismissed because you can't even go into the subject matter. It's not just about a piece of evidence. And that's what we saw again happen, sadly to say, under the current president, under President Obama. And the case I'm talking about is the Jeppesen case. You may have heard of it. It's an ACLU case concerning rendition program. The ACLU brought a case against Jeppesen, a subsidiary of Boeing. The Bush administration first asserted broad state secrets. The district court dismissed the case based on the Bush administration's claim. The case went up to the appeals court. The appeal was argued under the President Obama's administration. The court, when it asked the lawyer for President Obama's administration if it was asserting the same privilege as the Bush administration was, the Obama administration said it was. The court said, are you sure? Have you vetted this? The attorney for the Obama administration said they had. And the court, interestingly enough, gave a decision in favor of the ACLU against the government and said the case could proceed to trial. Next question was, what would the Barack Obama administration do with that? Would they appeal to the Supreme Court? Would they let the case go back to trial? Well, lo and behold, last week they did something that seems utterly contrary, not only to what Obama should have done, but to what he promised. Instead of letting the case go back to trial, they are appealing to what is called the on-bank decision of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which means all of the judges will hear the case if they take it. Rather than let the case go to trial, they've again claiming that they need broad state secret privilege. Here's what the ACLU said about that decision of the Barack Obama administration to seek review. Quote, no longer can there be any mistake that Obama has now fully embraced Bush's effort to immunize torturers and their enablers from any legal consequences for their actions. What more can you really say? Well, there's more to say, unfortunately. So that's one assertion of state secrets. But of course, we've had others by President Obama's administration that have now been really put out to really protect the torturers and the torture team and protect the American people, protect with quotes around it, from knowing what was done, what nasty conduct the Bush administration has done. I'm sure most of you are aware that President Obama reversed himself on release of the photographs of torture that took place throughout Iraq and Afghanistan, and said that he was not going to release those photos because it would cause too many people to be angry at America. Well, you know, that may or may not be the case, but of course, torture itself is why people are angry at America. It really should not be a debate over the photos. But my view is that in the long run, we're better to have those photos out so the American people can see what their government did and thereby take action to stop it in the future. And that will make us safer. Yes, there may be some cost to releasing the photos of conduct that was really, really bad and illegal. But at the same time, I think it's outweighed by not just our finding out about what happened, but finding out about it so that we can stop it in the future. But of course, that's not what Barack Obama apparently wants to see. So that's a continuation of the state secret policy on the photos. And we had a third decision, this one again last week, and that's about a CIA report. There was an internal report made by the CIA Inspector General in 2004 that is the most significant accounting of the agency's interrogation program. And it includes graphic details as to how the agency handled its detainees, its tortured detainees. There's been a request for that for a very long time. The government released a highly redacted form of that a couple of years ago under the Bush administration. The request again came to President Obama's administration, and again, and they plan again to broadly assert state secrets, and again, we will see hundreds of pages of torture testimony, torture treatment wiped out. So there you have it. State secrets in the rendition case, state secrets in the photos, state secrets in the CIA report. And then a last little piece, there's a couple of more, but a last little piece and a little bit far afield from the torture stuff. Recently, there's been a series of requests by human rights groups and others to get the visitors lists to the White House. Those are lists when you visit the White House, you sign a piece of paper and they have a list. And of course, President Bush refused to give those lists, and there was litigation about it. Remember, the oil companies had a meeting with Cheney or something like that, and they refused to give the list. And President Obama had said that he would not have such secrecy. And so far, the White House is refusing to turn over the lists of their visitors, including a specific request of what coal company officials came to visit the White House to discuss, presumably, the mining and burning of coal. So there you have it. An open government, or government that should be open, seems to be slamming its door in the face of the American people.
Europe's largest oil company, Royal Dutch Shell, settled a landmark lawsuit, agreeing to pay $15.5 million on the eve of a trial over its alleged involvement in human rights violation in the Niger Delta. The case was brought by relatives of human rights and environmental activists killed in Nigeria, who accused Shell of complicity in the 1995 executions of Nigerian writer and environmentalist Ken Saro-Wiwa and eight others. Charges in the case include summary execution, crimes against humanity, torture, inhumane treatment, arbitrary arrest, wrongful death, assault and battery, and infliction of emotional distress. With us today to look at the background of this case is Peter Weiss, Vice President of the Center for Constitutional Rights and Vice President of the International Association of Lawyers Against Nuclear Arms.
Peter Weiss, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Glad to be with you.
So, Peter, we want to get some background and really some of your reactions to the recent victory the Center for Constitutional Rights had in the case against Royal Dutch Shell and some of its affiliates. First, can you just give us a little bit of information about what was the result of that lawsuit, how many years it was pending?
It's been pending for 13 or 14 years, and it's gone through many preliminary cases in court, and finally it was ready for trial, and that's what prompted Shell to cave in and make a settlement. They knew all along that they were responsible, or that they were complicit with really terrible things that the Nigerian government did at their request to the Ogoni people, where Shell has a big oil project going.
That was, of course, one of the aspects that was the most well-known plaintiff was Ken Saro-Wiwa. His son was in New York for a while, and his grandfather is still, I think, still alive in Nigeria. But on the night of the victory, I think you went to the Center for Constitutional Rights party. I couldn't get there, but can you just talk about what happened there on the celebration?
The plaintiffs really took the initiative, our 10 Nigerian plaintiffs. And as somebody who's been to Africa I felt I was back in Africa. You know, they sang and they danced and they acknowledged everybody and they told jokes, and it was just a wonderful atmosphere. And it was wonderful for me because many years ago, decades ago, I was quite involved in the struggle against colonialism in Africa, including Nigeria, which I visited for the first time in 1953. And to me, what that settlement represented was a victory against neocolonialism, which is the bane of Africa now, the exploitation of Africa's resources by Western companies, the human rights violations that accompany that exploitation. And as Ken Sarawiwa said in his quote in the New York Times reporting on the case, he said, I hope this will send a signal. I think we all hope at the Center for Constitutional Rights and as friends of a free Africa that it will send a signal to other companies.
Now, Peter, one thing I wanted to go back to here is, you know, it's not as if the Shell case, the case by Ken Sarawiwa and other Ogoni people against Shell, came out of the blue. It came out of a particular legal development that you and the center and Rhonda Copeland really were instrumental in beginning, really, the first cases in which human rights violations taking place wholly in other countries could actually be litigated in the United States. And I want you to give us some history, because it didn't just emerge here. This was part of a struggle that you and the center were involved in really since the mid-70s, as far as I know. But it's about a statute, a 200-year-old statute called the Alien Tort Statute. And you were one of the discoverers of that and really argued the case, the seminal case in this, the Philartica case, that made that statute a weapon against human rights violations. So why don't you take us back to that period a little bit? Tell us how you discovered the statute, what you were thinking of when you did it, and what happened in the first major case that you won.
Well, actually, the history of the center's alien tort claims litigation is quite interesting. We first discovered that statute at the time of the My Lai massacre, which was a landmark event in the Vietnam War, where a company of American troops went to a village in Vietnam and killed almost every man, woman, and child in the village. And we did some research at the center to determine whether there was anybody we could sue for this horrible crime. And we came across the Alien Tort Statute, as it's called now, which is a one-sentence law that goes back to the first Judiciary Act of the United States in 1789, and it simply says that an alien shall have a right of action in district court for a violation of the law of nations, as international law was called in the 18th century. For various reasons, that case, the My Lai case, was never brought, but 10 years later, Amnesty got in touch with the center and said, we have this Paraguayan torturer here in New York, a police official who tortured to death the young son of one of the main opponents of General Stroessner, who was then the dictator of Paraguay. And we said, that's it. That's the Alien Tort Claims Act. So we brought that case, which became known as Philartica versus Peña Irala. Philartica was the name of the sister and father of the boy who was tortured to death. And that, in effect, revived that 200-year-old statute. It went up to the Court of Appeals in New York, which upheld the statute. It set the stage for many other cases. Hundreds of cases have been brought since then, mostly against foreign torturers and other gross human rights violators. But about 15 years ago, the center started thinking about applying that statute to the human rights crimes of corporations in foreign countries. And we've had two major victories in that. One was the Unocal case, where we demonstrated that Unocal, the California corporation, which had a huge contract with the Burmese government, was using slave labor. And that case was settled some years ago. And now, last week, the WeWork case was settled as well. And quite a few other cases could be brought. There's a case pending right now that is not directly the center's case, although the center has some involvement in it, against corporations that supported the South African regime during apartheid. And that case is likely to go to trial one of these days. And if you're familiar with what corporations are doing around the world, you can imagine how many such cases could be brought.
Right. We shouldn't underestimate, I think, the obstacles. You know, of course, when we sue individuals and when they come into the country having tortured abroad, it's one thing. When you sue a major corporation, of course, it has the deepest pockets in the world. And, of course, most law firms that might help us have some connection to the oil companies. So I guess it's difficult. Am I right, Peter?
Yeah, so it's more difficult to get help from major law firms, as we do in other cases. But it is still possible to do it. But, I mean, you're absolutely right. The problem with suing the corporations is that the corporations always say, well, we don't torture people. If the government of the local country, like Burma or Nigeria, executes, as in the case of WeWork, executes people or tortures people, that's not something that we should be held accountable for, when in fact it is possible to demonstrate, if you spend 13 years taking discovery and doing research, as we did in the WeWork case, that without the urging and active cooperation of that particular corporation, the executions and the torture would not have happened.
And in fact, Shell did not acknowledge any wrongdoing.
Company, you know, people who settle suits never acknowledge
right.
wrongdoing.
Right.
You never get an apology. We're speaking with Peter Weiss, a longtime vice president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, a distinguished attorney here in New York City. Peter, just give, in a nutshell, the kind of things that Shell was doing over there in Nigeria so that our listeners have an idea of why they were made defendants in the first place.
Well, Shell was actually paying some of the Nigerian soldiers that were committing these atrocities. The worst thing that they did was go to the Nigerian government and say, we have to get rid of these troublemakers. You know, Ken Sarawiwa, who was the leader of the Ogoni people and a highly respected writer and intellectual and activist in Nigeria and elsewhere, was leading this campaign to get Shell to stop polluting their homeland. What he did basically was go to the Nigerian government and say, you have to get rid of these people for us. You know, like a mafia boss saying to somebody, I don't like this guy, get rid of him.
Who was it that said it to his aides about Thomas Becket, the King of England, right? He said, what was the exact words? Who will rid me of this, whatever, something?
Damned.
So those kind of wink and a nod kind of statements have a long history, right, I think.
Yeah, but it was more than that. It was facilitating the operations of the Nigeria, because Nigeria was under a dictatorship at the time, and a corrupt dictatorship at that, which wanted Shell to continue to operate.
And more than a wink and a nod.
Right.
I know you've been at this now. I guess the argument took place in Philartica in 1980, is that right?
1978 was the argument, 1980 was the decision.
Right, under President Carter, and actually it was interesting, the administration supported the centers in your position in that case. And of course, since then, many administrations have tried to beat back that decision, but the Supreme Court finally upheld it. And so some, what is this now, 29 years later, 13 of those having litigated with Shell, finally, I think we're bringing to fruition some of what your expectations were back then. But give us some last feeling about how you feel, having seen really an important part, I think, of your life's work vindicated in terms of international law as well as the rights of people who are being oppressed.
Well, I feel like I haven't really wasted all of my life.
only the 15 minutes you just spent with us, right?
No, even that was not a waste.
Well, I do feel
good every time one of these cases. And you know, we're not the only ones bringing these cases now. There's the Center for Justice and Accountability out in California, and they have won victories against Salvadoran torturers and Chilean torturers. Every time one of those cases is won, I take a little bit of unhumble credit for it.
Well, thank you, Peter, and really, you were always the pioneer. When I first started at the center, I'll just tell this story. I came in as a civil rights lawyer in 1971 or so, the year of Attica, and went up there and all that. But Peter was around then, to put it mildly, and he made every one of us put an international law claim into every single lawsuit we filed. And we just thought Peter was like, I mean, we can't tell you that. What's this guy doing here, you know? And in the end, of course, Peter proved not just in Philartica to be right, but our Guantanamo cases had international law claims in there on arbitrary detention, Geneva Conventions, and Peter proved to be, I won't say a Cassandra, because that's someone who isn't believed in their own time, but Peter was partly believed, but turned out to be a tremendous foresight, though. We really just want to thank you.
I think we helped prove that international law has a role to play. Jerry Nadler had a hearing on the State Secrets Act, and in his opening statement, he said, you know, people bring these suits and the government comes in and says, state secret. The suit can't go forward, but there's an international law, said Congressman Jerry Nadler, that says that there has to be a remedy for every right. Well, I enjoyed hearing him say that, too.
Well, really, thank you again, Peter, and I'm sure, you know, not just obviously us at the center, but the Ogoni people in particular are pleased at the center in your work. Thanks, Peter.
Thank you. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. We go now to hear speakers from the event titled Torture and the Need for Justice, organized by Revolution Books. Among the speakers were journalist Laura Flanders, attorney Gita Gutierrez from the Center for Constitutional Rights, our own Michael Ratner, president of the center, Jeremy Scahill, and Sister Diana Ortiz, a survivor of torture. We'll now hear from Chris Hedges.
Thank you very much. I spent about 20 years abroad, and in most of those countries, torture, like war, was endemic. I was in Argentina at the end of the Dirty War. I covered Pinochet's Chile. I was in El Salvador and Guatemala, as well as Nicaragua for 5 years. From 1983 to 1988, on to the Middle East, and then in the former Yugoslavia, covering the war in Bosnia, where I was based in Sarajevo, when the city was being hit with 2,000 Serbian shells a day under constant sniper fire. And in every conflict that I covered, torture was an integral part of the weapon of war, because torture is the natural outcome of the culture of war. And it is the culture of war, the moral nihilism of war, that has infected our society in the same way that it infected those societies. Once you enter a binary worldview of us and them, of black and white, of good and evil, once you raise yourself to moral heights that implicitly denigrate the morality of others, once you dehumanize whole segments of your own population or populations that you oppose as human impediments to progress, torture becomes inevitable. Because in a war, in the landscape of war, human beings become objects, objects to either gratify or destroy or both. And in every war that I covered, it very soon became apparent to the killers that the routine of death needed to be enhanced. And this is why we would see bodies crucified on the sides of barns in Bosnia, decapitations, mutilations. It's why human bodies were used to deliver messages. When I covered the war in El Salvador, the death squads were killing between 700 and 1,000 people a month. One morning, outside of the Camino Royal, where we were working, left three bodies of campesinos, no doubt innocent, and they had cut off their genitals and stuffed them in the mouths of these corpses. These corpses greeted us. They knew we gathered every morning in the parking lot at dawn. You only work in daylight hours in a war zone. And on these corpses, they had put a sign that you, the piricuaco, was the slang term of sort of bastards in the press. This is what will happen to you. When you permit a class of killers and torturers as we have to be unleashed, you empower sadists. And that, of course, is what we have done. And let's remember that only 1% of those we hold are actually in Guantanamo. The Obama administration has forbidden any inspection of what is being done in Bagram, as well as the black sites around the world. When torture begins, the process, and we saw this through the U.S. Army School of the Americas, where 57,000 Latin American military, including Anastasio Somoza, Manuel Noriega, Roberto Dalbason, Leopoldo Galtieri, were all trained, unleashed these techniques on Latin America, you saw that very quickly torture was used as a kind of preemptive mechanism, so that initially you may have picked up people who may indeed have been the head of a dissident labor union or an Islamist cell that you suspect. But in the process of torture, there's a kind of centrifugal force where these people are tortured. They name others who invariably, I can tell you from experience, usually turn out to be innocent, any name to make the pain stop. These people are picked up and brought in, and there is a kind of sweeping or a rolling effect to torture. I think one of the things that has disturbed those of us so deeply who have come out of environments where torture is unleashed is that always these techniques are used on a defined segment of the population as the enemy, but always leach into the society at large when it is not stopped. You know, Michael said that, and it is true, that this is a campaign that is at its core racist. But in a societal breakdown, which we may very well face in the months ahead, especially as we desperately try and borrow our way back to a speculative or bubble economy, I think only prolonging perhaps by months an inevitable collapse, you will find these techniques and, of course, the hundreds of people who have been trained to use them within your own midst. So they may be Muslims today, but they may very well be Christians and Jews and agnostics and atheists and even members of Revolution Books tomorrow. Once you unleash these forces within society, there is almost no holding them back. And I think almost every conflict that I covered bears this out. When you look at, for instance, the dirty war in Argentina, which 30,000 of its own citizens disappeared, you saw how this subterranean force that lacked any kind of oversight and any kind of control mushroomed throughout the society and rent and tore Argentina apart. There is within the techniques that are used in Guantanamo and Bagram and other places, this and we've talked about waterboarding, which is banned, but the physical breakdown is this no-touch interrogation. And these were techniques that were developed primarily by psychiatrists and others who, of course, are in Guantanamo to monitor the physical deterioration and mental deterioration of the prisoners. These techniques were developed during the Cold War, and they have created sophisticated mechanisms by which people can be broken to a catatonic state through sensory deprivation, exhaustion, isolation. It's why you see people blindfolded, why you see them covered, and why you see earphones on their heads. And that technique, which I think when I covered the fall of East Germany, they talked about the Gestapo broke bones and the Stasi broke souls. And I think that technique of the physical disintegration of the soul, the reduction of somebody to essentially a fetal state, can often be parsed in a way by legal experts like John Yu and others. And remember, in the Inquisition, there were no shortage of legal experts that made everything done by the Inquisitors legal, courtesy of Loyola and the Jesuits. And I think that what we fail to understand is that by simply removing waterboarding and keeping all of these other mechanisms, which we have scientifically determined can reduce human beings to essentially states of insanity, we have not in any way blocked the effects of torture. You heard about the force feeding. There are 30 men right now being force fed. It's fascinating that at the beginning of these interrogations, when people were picked up in black sites, they were often force fed at a way to get them talk. And now every time they begin a hunger strike, they are immediately, while they're healthy, before they descend in any kind of physical decay, they are immediately strapped to these chairs 4 to 5 hours a day, covered in vomit, and used essentially and the pain becomes so unbearable that they break any kind of resistance. The feedings, which the CIA calls dietary manipulation, is considered, according to the manuals for interrogation, a legal conditioning technique. A lot of these people are just fed every 4 hours this dietary supplement called Ensure Plus, which is often mixed with a laxative that, of course, means that people are soon sitting in their own excrement. And there's going to be a great article on this that comes out in Harper's by Luke Mitchell called Yes, We Can Still Torture. He details, by interviewing many of the victims or the people who have been in Guantanamo, the processes that are still underway. I think the fear for those of us who come out of societies that have been convulsed by fear and that have resorted to torture as a mechanism for control. Well, when I covered Al-Qaeda after 9/11 based in Paris, and There wasn't an intelligence chief that I interviewed anywhere in Europe that year who ever used the word when or if when they were talking about another terrorist attack on American soil, but only when. And I think that should we suffer another domestic terrorist attack, should we suffer another catastrophic terrorist strike or an economic meltdown, these kinds of techniques, which have already been integrated into our society, will be practiced not in these offshore penal colonies and these black sites, but on American soil. That not only is this a violation against the rights and dignity of others, not only has it unleashed a class of sadists and killers, not only is it woefully ineffective and illegal and immoral, but as Thucydides understood in the declining days of the Athenian Empire, the tyranny that, as Thucydides wrote, the tyranny that Athens imposed on others, it soon imposed on itself. And it was empire and tyranny that destroyed Athenian democracy and all of the tools of empire and tyranny that killed the light of Athenian democracy. And I think we too, when we battle against torture, are not only standing up for international law and for the sanctity of human life, but finally for the protection of our very anemic democratic state. Thank you.
That was Chris Hedges speaking at the event titled Torture and the Need for Justice. We'll now hear from journalist Laura Flanders speaking at the event titled Torture and the Need for Justice.
I'm going to talk about the power of the media because I am fed up by the media coverage that we are getting of this moment. I want to take you back when you had the dueling national security speeches. Do you remember that? And Barack Obama, Jeremy is completely right. People want to believe in Barack Obama. I did a whole book in 2006, it came out in 2007, called Blue Grit. And it was about a rising tide of progressive folks who realized the Democratic Party sucked and they had to do something about it. And a lot of them looked at the options and they said, well, you know what, we're just going to bite the bullet and we're going to get involved in electoral politics one way or another. And they ran for local office and they did local action and they were effective in helping to change things at the local level where they live. It had an effect on the 2006 congressional races. And when it came to 2008, the reason that Barack Obama won and Hillary Clinton didn't win the nomination, it was because he understood what was there to be tapped into. Did he create a progressive movement? No, a progressive movement created him. And they wanted better than this. So when I think about what Jeremy said about the importance and the urgency of a radical critique right now, it's because I'm thinking of those people who put their hopes and their dreams into this guy and the possibility of change. Were they stupid to do that? No, our media tells us that's what politics is. You pick one guy once every 4 years, and it's almost always a guy, and you give them your vote and then you go home, right? So I don't blame people for thinking it's all about that guy. I do work every day at Grit TV to remind them that it's actually about we the people. But so people want to believe in Barack Obama, right? They want to believe because they want life to change in their lives and in their communities. It's not just about changing personnel in the White House. It's about changing their reality where they live. And they listened to the speech that Barack Obama gave a week ago, and they heard some great stuff. The trouble is they heard a lot of contradictory stuff. He says one thing and he does another, but in fact he says both things. In that one speech, he lifted up America's timeless ideals, right? He also called for timeless detention. You can't do both. He paid homage to the rule of law, but he said we may still need some special tribunals. You can't do both. He said, we're going to reclaim the Constitution, but he's still talking about juries for some and not for others, and judges for some and not for the rest. He's still not pushing for a special prosecutor. He's saying, we'll wait and see. You can't have the Constitution and special courts for some. They had that in colonial England. The Constitution was supposed to get rid of all that stuff. That's why a lot of people like me went from there to here. You can't have special treatment and special courts and equality for all. All people created equal. And Barack Obama said, the problem, one of his most powerful lines was, the problem of Guantanamo is not the closing of Guantanamo, because that's the problem that's been problematized in the media. He said it's not the closing of Guantanamo, it was the opening of Guantanamo. And of course, on one level, he's right. But it's a cop-out, because the problem is also the closing of Guantanamo. If it doesn't also mean the closing of all the other black sites, so-called, and why are they always called black when they're supposed to be bad, the closing of all those other black sites all across the world. The conversation we need to be having is about the problems in Barack Obama's plan. But I went on MSNBC last week to talk about this very thing, or maybe it was 2 weeks ago, and there's no room to talk about the problems of Barack Obama's plan, because we have to talk about Dick Cheney. And where were all the speeches of Al Gore broadcast live when he was the former vice president? Why are we listening to Dick Cheney? And why is MSNBC and CNN all giving him live airtime for his speeches? And why is he making them? We're feeding into it every time we allow the discussion to be between Barack Obama and Dick Cheney. But where do we go for the rest? Dick Cheney gets away with talking about having kept us safe. Who's the us, Dick? Not us people in Afghanistan, not us people in Palestine, not us people in Iraq. And I said last week, because it was the week before, or 2 weeks ago, but the week before Memorial Day, I said, kept us safe? Tell that to the mourning families on Memorial Day. Didn't keep them safe. And this week I would say, tell that to the people of Wichita, Kansas. I went back and looked. We've had a Department of Homeland Security, right? Homeland, don't you feel better? Had a Department of Homeland Security, bigger and bigger, more and more money. What was the FBI's number one domestic terror threat this time last year? And it had been for years. Anybody know? Eco-terrorism. And when Barack Obama put together a report, the Department of Homeland Security put out a report on domestic terror threats, and it actually went so far as to include people like those who killed Dr. George Tiller. And that guy did not act alone. When they put groups like that and white supremacist groups like the Freemen and the Aryan Nation, all the rest in that list, well, believe it or not, surprise, surprise, they got flack from right-wing crazy people. His trouble is all those right-wing crazy people are on television every night. So what did the Barack Obama administration do? Back away from their report. How do they look now? Stupid. So I want to go back to the beginning tableau that we saw. And I'm not a member of the RCP, I'm not a member of World Can't Wait, but I thank you for doing what you do. It's ridiculous that this is the size of this group. And I've been moved every time I've seen those people at demonstrations all across this country for the last however many years it is, it's too many years. So I want to thank you for being everywhere you have been and being here tonight. And I want us to think about those hooded men and women. We can't allow ourselves to be hooded. We cannot decide that it is easier to just put on the hood. And we can't allow our friends to do it either. Geeta was absolutely right. July 4th is coming up, but don't wait till July 4th. There are a lot of people out there who just don't want to talk about this stuff anymore. And I am afraid it is up to you to be the communicator. For all those people in hoods, it's up to you to communicate. It's up to you to ask the questions. It's up to you to carry the stories. You may love Keith Olbermann, you may love Rachel Maddow, but they're not going to do it for you. Honestly, they're not. And as easily as they brought us some slightly more progressive programming on MSNBC, so they can also take it away. We have to make our own media. We have to develop our own megaphones. We have to connect with each other, leverage our support where we have it, which is laterally, not vertically. Connect with each other, support media that you care about. Don't be hooded. Speak up. Thanks.
That was journalist Laura Flanders speaking at the event titled Torture and the Need for Justice. We'd like to take a few minutes now to thank our affiliate stations around the country.
You know, we broadcast out of studios on Wall Street in New York City to the tri-state area on this tremendously powerful transmitter. But we've got 19 other stations that carry our program from coast to coast and even in Alaska. And we wanted to mention them and thank all our listeners out there.
Well, we have WHYS, which is Eau Claire Community Radio, 96.3 FM in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. KRFP, Radio Free Moscow, 92.5 FM, Moscow, Idaho. WRFN in Nashville, Tennessee, Radio Free Nashville, 98.9 FM.
And we also have KSOW in Cottage Grove, Oregon, 106.7 FM. WYAP in Clay, West Virginia, 101.7 FM. And KRFC, 88.9 FM in Fort Collins, Colorado.
WRCT, 88.3 FM, Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. KWMD, 90.7 Kasilof, 104.5 FM radio, Anchorage, Alaska. We also have WXOJLP, 103.3 FM in Northampton, Massachusetts.
And KEIF FM at 104.7 in Enid, Oklahoma. And Fort Royal, Virginia is broadcasting our show at 1640 AM. And also in Asheville, North Carolina, WPVM, that's 103.5 FM.
ISPCA Radio, Indiana, online to Chicago, Auckland, Atlanta, Boston, and Melbourne. Also, Moton Community House Radio, which is online, and WLRI in Gap, Pennsylvania.
And we have WPRR at 1680 AM in Grand Rapids, Michigan. WCRS in Columbus, Ohio, which is a community radio station broadcasting to Central Ohio. And KKFI, 90.1 FM in Kansas City, Missouri.
We have Free Radio Santa Cruz. Thank you for joining us, Free Radio Santa Cruz. That's our newest edition. And of course, as always, our local station WBAI, New York City, 99.5 FM.
We want to give a big welcome to our new affiliate, WSLR-FM, 96.5, Sarasota Community Radio. Thank you for joining us.